on against the grain. Revelations that the much lionized United Farm Workers leader Cesar Chavez raped women and young girls has rightly horrified many. But Chavez has long been a controversial figure, and the union that he headed was deeply divided. We present a conversation I had with former farm worker and radical Frank Bardeke about the two souls of the UFW. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The United Farm Workers Union has become legendary. It battled the growers of California and beyond, launched a 5-year boycott of table grapes, won pay raises for its members, and captured the imaginations of progressives around the country. But beneath the surface of the union were significant divisions, which ultimately shaped the destiny of the UFW and led to its decline. On the one side were the union staff, mainly Mexican-American, with a particular vision for the UFW. On the other were militant rank-and-file workers from Mexico who had long traditions of radical struggle. Former farm worker Frank Bardeke, who labored alongside these rank-and-file workers, wrote about those different visions in his book, Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers. Here's a conversation I had with him from 2011. How did you first become involved with the United Farm Workers and with farm work in the Salinas Valley?
I picked up a hitchhiker who, in 1971, who said he had just worked in the fields of the Salinas Valley, that there had been a big strike in 1970 in Salinas, and the UFW had won the strike, and you could actually go into the UFW office and get a dispatch and go out to the fields. I discovered in the fields a whole life that was fascinating to me, and I was unprepared for. It was kind of like coming into Detroit in 1938, right after the sit-in strike, and sort of feeling the momentum and the power that the workers had in 1938, because UFW had won this strike the year before. And so the crews that we were on together were very powerful people and had a sense of their own efficacy. And eventually, within a couple of years, I worked myself onto a piece rate crew, a collective piece rate crew, the crews that I write about in my book, which in the 1970s, the mid-1970s, made very good money. It was like what the golden age for California farm workers. So I worked on a celery crew in the mid-1970s where we made $14 an hour. And we worked 6 months a year, and then we got top unemployment the rest of the 6 months, and it worked. It was a job.
So you differ then from some members of the New Left who went into industrial work or factory work, agricultural work, to organize people as part of a kind of a radical New Left agenda. You're saying that you actually became part of this because you were just looking for work. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. And that's actually kind of an interesting thing, because when I left Berkeley, I was kind of exhausted with the possibilities of youth culture. I like to sort of seem like a dead end. So when I went into the fields, I actually was sort of wiped out, washed out politically. I was pretty, I felt pretty low politically. And it was farm workers and the farm where the life on the crew and the level of struggle, the level of daily struggle, which kind of revived my political hope.
So what did you actually see then when you arrived to these fields and saw workers who really had a sense of their own power? What did that look like? How did it manifest itself?
It's kind of the essential thing that somebody has to understand or to rethink if they want to understand the history of the United Farm Workers Union. And that is that farm workers, even though they were not able to build a permanent union, actually have a lot of periodic power in the fields, especially during harvest time. Agriculture is very special that way. It's a very special kind of industry because the product is not continuous. You have to invest money. You have to pay for the ground rent. You have to weed. You have to put money into weeding. You have to pay people to weed. You have to apply the pesticides if you're going to be that kind of farmer. There's all kinds of money that has to be put in, and then the harvest is a very short duration. So if farm workers strike during a harvest time, as growers have complained all their, throughout California history, if farm workers strike during harvest time, effectively, it's a disaster for the grower because when the strike's over, he can't warehouse the product and then work people double time or triple time. So farm workers historically actually have quite a bit of power, periodic power, not the kind of extensive power that allow them to build a union, but periodic power during harvest time. And they are used to using it. And they were used to using it when I got there. So we would see people the very first weeks we got there, people, if they smelled pesticides in the fields, wouldn't get off the bus. They wouldn't get off the bus. They'd stay in the bus until and demand that somebody would come out and inspect the fields. If people would work at their own pace, it was very difficult for the foreman to speed them up. Another thing, important thing about agriculture production is that it's not mechanized. It's not really mechanized. It was unsuccess. They tried to mechanize it because they wanted to mechanize farm workers out of existence. But in vegetables and fruits, where the UFW was strong, people still work with tools in their hands, and they're not driven by any machine. And so they work at their own pace. And if they're working by the hour, it's very difficult to speed them up. What happens with farm workers, and this happens to this day, this happens even periods of strength or periods of weakness. What happens if you try to speed farm workers up and they're working by the hour and they don't want to speed up? They'll skip over the plants. They won't weed the plants right, or they won't harvest everything that needs to be harvested. So I remember talking to my buddy who I was there with, who was also somewhat of a veteran of the student movement. I saw the student movement in the 60s was pretty powerful. I lived through it. But I saw a level of daily struggle and a collective action in the fields that was unknown to me in the student movement. The student movement was more like pulsating movement. So that's one thing. The second thing that's really important is that on the piece rate cruise, which I got onto after a couple of years, people work collectively. People are paid collectively. So crew of lechugueros, of lettuce cutters or apieros or celery workers, they are paid one price for every box of celery or box of lettuce they produce, and then they split it evenly among themselves. So the jobs, that's a very collective kind of work, and the jobs are distributed to be equally difficult, equally hard. And people work very hard at distributing, making the jobs equally hard and equally difficult. And on those crews, which, as I say, were well paid, I made $14 an hour in those years. Lechugueros, lettuce cutters, made $20 an hour. We're talking
about 19. Which in today's dollars would be what?
I think it's at least twice as much. In my book, I think it's like $50 an hour. So that's a lot of money. You know, you don't think of that as a farm worker wage.
Indeed not.
But that's what farm workers are making. And there were about 3,000 lechugueros in the Salinas Valley. It wasn't a small proportion of the people who worked in the Salinas Valley. But the other thing about these crews is that they were made up of relatives. Fathers and sons sometimes, brothers, cousins, or people from the same small towns in Michoacán or in Jalisco, and they stayed together. They stayed together over years, so you had a sort of sense of solidarity and closeness and connectedness, and the crews had leaders. There were people who people looked to for leadership, and all of that happened before the UFW ever got there. And that was not that. These people were not empowered by the UFW. These people had power before the UFW ever arrived. Now their power was periodic. It was strongest in harvest time, and they had not been able to build a union, but they had power nonetheless.
You write actually very beautifully about the labor process in the farms and how really runs against the kind of assumptions that most of us make about farm work being unskilled labor, presumably because now it's so poorly paid, there's an assumption that it must really involve very little skill. But you suggest that it's actually one of the few places within highly advanced capitalist production which has not been de-skilled, that the parallels that are often made by terms like industrial farming or, you know, the famous book, Factories in the Field, actually really conjures up a very inaccurate image of what is happening
within the labor process on a farm that it actually has nothing to do with some person doing kind of monotonous, single, unskilled job on an assembly line. Can you explain all of that? And I mean, because it's really a fascinating aspect of this story.
You read the book. You got it. Terrific. It is. I mean, I have talked about it a little bit. When the Bracero program was ending...
And the Bracero program was a guest worker program that was in place between 1942 and 1964, which was a kind of a way of bringing in labor from Mexico that was controlled and wages were kept down. So sort of a not an entirely free form of labor.
That's right. That's a contracted labor, semi-free. People could not move from job to job. Once the harvest was over, people were sent back to Mexico. And wages were sort of frozen. In 42, when it first started, wages were about 90 cents an hour. And in 1964, when it ended, wages were $1.25 an hour. This is the same period when the rest of the U.S. working class is actually advancing in terms of wages and working conditions. And that's when farm workers fell way behind the rest of the working class in terms of their wages. Before the Second World War, going up into the Second World War, farm worker wages are really not that much behind industrial wages. Somebody, David Runson, estimates at about 85% to 90%. And in some specific areas, farm worker wages were higher than industrial wages. People would leave industrial jobs in Los Angeles in the 1920s and 1930s to go work on the field in the fields because they could make more money in the fields. So the Bracero program is that's when farm workers fell way behind industrial wages. And so that going into the period of where the UFW is victorious, farm worker wages are about 60% of industrial wages. But that was as a result of that special period. Well, the growers were extremely worried about what would happen when they lost their tens of thousands of contracted laborers. And so they had one of the things that they dreamed of was to mechanize the fields. But in fact, they didn't manage to mechanize the fields. The only thing that they really mechanized was canning tomatoes, where they developed a canning machine and a tomato that matured evenly enough so that the machine could go through and harvest the tomatoes. But fresh tomatoes are still harvested by hand. The problem that they had, and they haven't been able to solve so far, the reason they cannot mechanize agriculture is because nature matures unevenly. And so when you go through, say, for instance, and harvest a broccoli field, you have to go through several times because the buds on the broccoli plant mature unevenly and somebody has to come in and cut the ones that are ready and leave the ones that aren't ready behind for the next cut through and then do that again. You go through a broccoli field maybe 3, 5, 6 times during a season. And they can't devise a machine that can do that. They can't devise a machine that's as keen as the human sight, and nor a cutting machine that's as cunning as the human hand. And so we think of industrial agriculture, and what Carey McWilliams meant by factories in the fields was not that the jobs itself had been industrialized. He meant one very important, to him, extremely important thing, because industrial workers had been covered by the National Labor Relations Act. And he was part of a movement to have farm workers covered by the National Labor Relations Act.
Right, so they were exempted from it in the 1930s.
Farm workers were. So he said, look at, these are factories in the fields, so farm workers should be covered by the National Labor Relations Act. And what he meant by that, that was what he was trying to achieve with that title. And he also meant, of course, that they were on huge farms, that people worked on huge farms, and that they were not peasants. They were an industrial proletariat. But he did not mean, nor is it true to this day, that farm work resembles, in the labor process, anything like industrial production.
Before we get to how the United Farm Workers were formed and the impact that they had on these social relations, what was the conditions for workers in the fields preceding the advent of the United Farm Workers? Because you did say that people, even before they were unionized, mm-hmm. had some degree of collective power, mm-hmm. yet also the conditions were very stark.
Well, like so much in California agriculture, you have to answer that question depending upon what crop you're talking about. because their crops in 64, when the Bracero program ended, and it's no accident that the UFW starts in 65, the National Farm Workers Association was started in 62, but the grape strike happens in 65. It happens in the year following the end of the Bracero program. That's no accident. There was a labor shortage for a short period of time, and a labor shortage is always advantageous to workers. And so there was a whole series of strikes in 65, not just the grape strike, in which farm workers' wages went up because they'd been artificially held down at this $1.25 an hour. And so wages, you know, went up very sharply. In the vegetables, that's where most of the braceros were working. So it was a bracero. It was like a bracero world. And the conditions were the conditions that you would expect in a semi-captive workforce. Although the braceros themselves actually engaged in a lot of strikes in the early 60s. There's a famous strike that, well, it's not so famous. Let's hope it's famous after I wrote my book. But there's a strike that I talk about in 1960, 61 in the Imperial Valley, which is kind of the beginning, I think, of the farm worker movement, independent of the UFW. And that was a strike of lechugueros, of lettuce workers. And in that time, there were a tremendous number of braceros who worked in the lettuce fields. And braceros had been used historically to break what they call domestic, that would be legal California residents, who were Mexicans also, but legal California residents. Braceros had been used to break their strikes. So very early in the strike, the strikers went out to the labor camp where the braceros were held, and they sat down, you know, several hundred strong. They sat down in front of the gate where the braceros would be taken out to be taken to break their strike. And the cops came, and they would threaten to use tear gas, and they called it an illegal assembly. And all this time, the braceros had been bussed up to the gate to be ready to be broken through. Well, these are both Spanish speakers. Both the people are sitting down in front, and the people in the buses. And like an hour or so into the demonstration, some braceros started climbing the fence, the chain link fence, working their way through the barbed wire at the top and joining the demonstration, actually joining the sit-in. And that was kind of like the beginning and the end of the Bracero program.
Because its days were numbered.
Yeah, its days were numbered because that was a clear demonstration to everybody that Braceros had been here long enough and were familiar enough with the land. They could know what they could get to, and they were going to join the struggle. And as a matter of fact, Senator Clary Engel at that time, who was the senator from California, Republican liberal from California, said that the Bracero program is going to end. And that's when Bud Antle signed with the Teamsters, because he could see that the Bracero program was going to end, and he decided to sign with a union.
And say who he is?
Bud Antle was the owner of the largest lettuce grower in the world at the time. So he signed with the Teamsters because he could see that that unionism was coming. And so he wanted to sign with a union that he could work with rather than a more militant union that he was afraid of. Actually, very far-reaching decision, very, very, very insightful decision. Chavez was also there in 1960-61 as a CSO leader, a leader of the community service organization, which was working in support of the strike. And he saw the power of that. And it was the next year that he left the CSO to form the National Farm Workers Association, which became the UFW. So like you can think of Antle on one side as seeing that the Bracero program is coming to an end, the whole situation in the fields is going to be different. And then you see Chavez on the other side, who can see that the Bracero program is going to come to an end and the thing is going to be different, and there's going to be an opportunity to build a union.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with Frank Bardicky. He is the author of Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers. That's published by Verso. So I want to ask you about the origins of the United Farm Workers, which mm-hmm. you've just actually been getting to. Histories of the United Farm Workers tend to place founder Cesar Chavez absolutely at the center of their stories, whether their take is hagiographic or critical of him, but he is in the center. You set out to write a book that did not do this, instead focused on the rank and file. Why is that?
First answer is that I think if you think of the history of the United Farm Workers Union as an aspect of the biography of Cesar Chavez, you can't understand what happened. You just can't understand it. It just is a mystery. What people get into all kinds of weird explanations of what happened. Caesar went crazy or there's like lots of the Synanon game came or there's lots
of... You mean why the United Farm Workers eventually declined?
Eventually declined. You can't understand it if you just consider it as an aspect of Caesar's biography. So that's one reason. That I decided to focus on the rank and file. The other reason that I just focused, well, it's also certain ideological reasons. I mean, clearly, I believe in the rank and file. I believe in the power of the rank and file. So that's an ideological reason. But thirdly, when I started to write the book, what I wanted to write about was these crews, these farm worker crews that I just described a little bit before, because nobody else was ever going to write about them because they're monolingual Spanish speakers. There are hardly any writers among them. There's a lot of people are illiterate. They are there are wonderful and marvelous storytellers because they live in an oral culture, and they're smart and skilled. But nobody was going to tell their story because there's nobody from that group who would tell their story. But it turned out that if you just told the story of the UFW through their eyes, it would be a kind of a corrective to telling it as a biography of Cesar Chavez. But it wouldn't really make sense either. That wouldn't make sense either. You had to tell their story in relationship to the story of the UFW staff and the relationship between farm worker power and staff power, and you had to tell that story in relationship to the UFW as a boycott organization. And it was by itself, those stories alone don't make sense. When you understand the trajectory of the UFW as periods when the boycott advocacy staff's soul of the union and the farm worker soul of the union were working together in conjunction as the periods of success, and then the periods when those two souls of the union were in conflict as the period of UFW failure, then things become clear.
Well, so with that in mind, that complex history from below, maybe a little history from above, combined approach, how then do you describe the origins of the United Farm Workers?
After a number of increasing strikes in the late 50s and the early 60s in the fields, which Cesar Chavez observed, especially this one important strike in the Imperial Valley in 1960-61. Cesar, who had been working for 8 years, and finally it was 10 years, in an organization called the Community Service Organization, which was an Alinskyite organization.
That is inspired by the organizer, Saul Alinsky.
Right, it's inspired and funded. Decided that it was time to organize farm workers. And there was an AFL-CIO organization, AWOC, which was not doing a good job. And so he decided it was time to organize. And he tried to get CSO to organize it, to try to put a lot of money and staff into farm workers, and they wouldn't. And so he left the CSO and he founded what he called the National Farm Workers Association. Now, the National Farm Workers Association, he didn't call it a union. And part of the reason he didn't call it a union is because unions had a bad reputation in the fields and had been associated with a lot of failures. But part of it is because he didn't really have a union in mind. He had more like a community organization. It would be focused on the job, but it would also have a lot of extend in the community. And so they signed up families in the Farm Workers Association, the National Farm Workers Association. I also want to add, before I go on, that CSO was the most successful Mexican-American service organization in the United States in the 1950s, the most successful one. The people who organized it were Cesar and Dolores and Gilbert Padilla and Helen, the very same people who organized the National Farm Workers Association. These people had been successful. It is no accident that they were successful in building the United Farm Workers Union. They knew what they were doing. These are not just like, these are people who are trained in politics. They make their living in politics. So the National Farm Workers Association was founded in 1962, and for 3 years they did things like they told people about the labor commissioner, would take people to the labor commissioner if they had disputes on their jobs. They helped people with social service agencies. They're kind of like a service. They had a service center. They had a funeral plan, a life insurance plan. They arranged some health clinics. There was like a social service notion. And they also worked closely with liberals in the Democratic Party to try to change the laws, to make the laws more favorable to farm workers. Remember, at this time, farm workers have been completely left out of the New Deal, don't have unemployment insurance, don't have disability insurance. They're kind of a separate caste of worker. So they're working in that kind of way. Then the Bracero program ends, and there's this strike wave. Maybe there's 100 people in the National Farm Workers Association. It's hard to say how many. There weren't that many. It was slow getting off the ground. Maybe there's a couple hundred families. Nobody knows for sure. So the Bracero program ends, and there's this strike wave throughout California. And the Filipino farm workers who made up the UFW, the National Farm Workers Association, is based in the Delano area among grape pickers. Delano area is a very special area in California because it was a place where there were Mexican-American farm workers, people whose parents and grandparents had come in the 1920s, people who were somewhat bilingual, people who suffered in U.S. schools, but who were still working in the fields. In the vegetables, it had been almost entirely braceros. But not in around Delano. And you have to remember that Chavez, Dolores, Gilbert, and Helen, the founders, are all Chicanos as opposed to Mexicans. Caesar's grandfather voted in Texas, and grandfather and father homesteaded farms in Arizona. Dolores was born in.
Of course, Dolores Huerta.
Dolores Huerta was born in New Mexico. Gilbert was born in Los Baños. These are Mexican Americans organizing among Mexican Americans. The other people, now, by the way, today the demographic is totally different. Today, 90% of the people who work in the California fields were born outside of the United States, most of them in Mexico. But while the Bracero program was going on up until 64, there were these little pockets of white workers, African American workers, Tejano workers, Mexican American migrants, Mexican American settled farm workers. That's where the NFWA was founded. The other group of workers in the grapes, important group, about 30% were Filipino workers. When the Bracero Filipinos who had come in the 1920s, they were mostly elderly men, although there are still some younger men with them. When the Bracero program ended, the Filipinos struck for higher wages. The Filipinos are like the bearers of the union tradition in California fields. They have the richest union history. They had been involved in many, many strikes. They had built two unions which were very successful in the 1930s. Very few people know about them, but they were successful unions. Filipino unions, the National Filipino Labor Union, was the most successful around Stockton. These people knew how to strike. They struck. They were, however, only 30% of the workforce. They knew people could see that they were going to be defeated. The National Farm Workers Association was working in the same area in the same crop, had to decide what they were going to do about that. People went to Chavez and to Gilbert, and they said, what should we do? So they had to make it, from the very beginning, they said, honor the Filipino picket lines. But the Filipinos were only picketing at those crews where they worked. So at that point, Chavez himself decided, even though he assumed that they were going to lose the strike, that it was important that the National Farm Workers Association call the Mexican workers out on strike too. And he decided that because there had been a tradition in the California fields of Mexicans scabbing on Filipino strikes and Filipino scabbing on Mexican strikes. That was more common. And he understood that you needed, like, an act of solidarity between Mexicans and Filipinos would be the basis for an organization in the Central Valley that could possibly be victorious. So that even though it was he felt that he was going into a losing strike, he called folks out on strike. He also, when he did that, had the vision that, because remember, we're talking about 1965, and there's been several years where the civil rights movement in the South has been supported by liberals in the North, and that support was important to them. So he had this idea that somehow he didn't know how. This is before boycotts are famous or one of the things that we think of right away. He didn't know how, but he thought that maybe liberals and unions across the country could be mobilized to support what he figured was going to be a losing strike and could augment farm worker power. And, you know, it was incredibly insightful and sort of he earned his place in California history with that particular insight, because people did go out on strike. After a couple of weeks, the strike was defeated. The UFW decided to keep the strike alive kind of notationally. I mean, it wasn't, what does it mean to be on strike when, you know, there's no harvest going on? But they kept the idea of the strike alive. They had what they called legitimacy strikes for the next three or four years, where people did went out on strike, but it really was just to support the boycott or to give the boycott legitimacy. And there was built by the UFW the most powerful boycott in American history, which then forced the growers to sign, even though the growers had won in the fields. The NFWA became, which was an association, became the UFW during that period. Then Chavez sort of put his misgivings about unions on the back burner and became a unionist.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today we're discussing the history of the United Farm Workers. My guest is Frank Bardicky, and he's the author of a new book, Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers. That's published by Verso Books, and we have a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. He's also the author of Good Liberals and Great Blue Herons. You were describing actually a number of the different constituents, let's say, at play in the United Farm Workers when it sort of burst onto the scene with this boycott, which galvanized people all over the country. And you've been describing elements of it within the farm workers themselves, the leadership and staff of the union who were actually Mexican Americans, people whose families had been in the United States for quite a long time, often the component of the Filipino workers, and then, of course, alluding to the white left and others who joined in to support the grape boycott itself. Tell us more about who made up the rank and file of the United Farm Workers, and where did they come from, not simply just in terms of geography, but politically, socially, what made them so distinct?
There's no way to answer that question without talking about different crops. This is another thing that might be a surprise to most people. People in generally aren't farm workers. People are grape workers or celery workers or lettuce workers or lemon pickers or orange pickers or, well, lemon pickers and orange crippers overlap, mm-hmm. Strawberry workers. And all these different crops, there are different people who work in them, in the fields. So that in 1965, the people who worked in the grapes were Mexican Americans and Tejanos. Mexican-Americans, Tejanos, and Filipinos, migrants from Texas. The Mexican-Americans were rooted in the area around Delano. They were no longer migrants. The labor process in the grapes is not as collective as the labor process in the vegetables. People are... organized into small groups, often family groups, and get paid by the family group. And that would be part of a much larger crew. So that in the grapes, when the grape strike happened, some of those families would walk out and some of them would stay on strike. Whereas in the vegetables, that never happened. The crew either went out together or it stayed in together. Because the crew itself, the 35 or 30, 37 men and women, or often just men, were so united that it was just inconceivable that someone would scab and some would strike. So that gave the vegetable workers like more power than the grape workers. So the answer to your question is that when you go to the vegetables, you meet a whole different group of people. And these people had originally been braceros. Some of them became green carters, and some of them, after the end of the bracero program, came back as people without papers, They came from Michoacán, Jalisco, Guanajuato, that area of Mexico, and they were very often Cardenistas. They came from Cardenista families, followers of Lázaro Cárdenas. He's the Franklin Roosevelt, to put it very crudely, the Franklin Roosevelt of Mexico. The president of Mexico, who sort of partially fulfilled the promise of the Mexican Revolution, distributed a lot of land to the peasantry.
In the 1930s.
The fathers of these people, these farm workers, were Cardenistas. And the farm workers themselves were Cardenistas, some of them highly political. One of the heroes of my book is a guy by the name of Ermilo Mojica. And actually, his name was changed at the border. It's kind of like a Ellis Island story. His name is really Mojica. And anybody who's familiar with Mexican history, his great uncle was Francisco Mojica, who's part of the Cardenas cabinet, the person most responsible for the nationalization of gringo oil in the 1930s. That was like his uncle, you know. His father was a PRI official in the days that PRI was a kind of semi-revolutionary.
That's the ruling party.
Yeah, the ruling party, but it was a left party at that time. So these folks who are farm workers and who were on these collective crews that I just described were also highly politicized. Another one of the heroes of my book, Aristeo Zambrano, his grandfather had walked from Chavinda, where he lived, to Mexico City to get the documents for Chavinda to become a ejido, a collective farm back in Chavinda. And Cardenas personally gave him a rifle. Cardenas' own rifle, which this man brought home because Cardenas told him, look, I gave you a piece of paper that says you own the land. Here's the rifle that you're going to need to protect it. And that man's grandson became a leader in the United Farm Workers Union. He also, when he was a young man, when he was 14 years old, he walked around Chavinda collecting money for the students in Mexico City in 1968. One of the things that people have to, an unknown fact about the UFW that people have to understand, is that in some ways it's not that different than the rest of the stories of immigrants in the United States, the way that Italian immigrants and Irish immigrants built a labor movement in the United States. They brought with them political ideas when they immigrated. That also happened in the UFW. So the UFW power on the ground among the Mexicans was built by highly political people, very much like the Europeans who came to the United States and built a labor movement. So this is not, again, you have to, not only are these people skilled, high paid, collectively organized, but they have political ideas of their own, which are somewhat different than the political ideas of the union staff as led by Cesar Chavez.
And so how did those two differing perspectives on organizing, on understanding the world, come to clash within the United Farm Workers, which of course is the central issue of your book, Trampling Out the Vintage?
Well, yeah, you got to read the book for that one. It gets pretty exciting. It's both inspiring and tragic at the same time. The best way to put it, there's a sort of a structural explanation. One of the things that people have to understand about the UFW, if you want to understand UFW history, is that there were no locals inside the UFW. Ordinarily in a union, there's a local office, a local unit, it's called a local, which collects dues where people are voted into local office. And so there's local officials, and then that local has to send a proportion of their dues to the national office, and then they keep a proportion themselves. And within a lot of American unions, there's a tremendous amount of autonomy that they have. And in the UFW, nothing like that existed. Instead of local offices, there were field offices where the people in the field offices were appointed by the executive board, ultimately appointed by Cesar Chavez. So the people who worked in the fields had no way to elect anybody onto the UFW staff. They had no way to get their to express their power on the staff. They expressed it, outside the staff. They would be able to go to the union hall and scream and shout and very often got their way. And in periods of mass movements, they worked in close cooperation with that union staff, but they had no formal power inside the union. So that was complicated by the fact that the staff itself had other sources of income, so that they didn't live, the staff didn't live entirely off farm worker dues. For most of the life of the UFW, they got more money from other unions and from donations, and from reinvesting and their health plan and their pension plan than they got from farm worker dues.
So they were less accountable to their members. Hence,
they're less accountable to the members in terms of their financial condition, and they're less accountable to the members because there's no way the members can elect themselves to the staff. They can't get on the staff unless they're appointed. Anybody on the staff owes their job to Chavez and not to the people below them. There's always in any union, there's going to be some kinds of tensions, troubles, if you will, contradictions, mild contradictions between the rank and file and the staff. That's just built into the problem, built into the situation. It's a question of how you handle them. In the UFW, that contradiction was tremendously intensified because no rank and filer could get elected onto the staff, and because the staff had its an independent source of income. What happened is after the 1979 strike, the 1979 strike was a very interesting strike, probably the most successful strike in California farm worker history. The union won a tremendous victory, and they won it in the fields. So they did not win it through the boycott. And in the process of that victory, one of the things that they won was the right to elect people to as full-time paid representatives. So this would be the first time in UFW history that people could be elected onto the staff, basically. Well, Chavez had, during the middle of that strike, had felt that the strike should be called off and that everybody should go on the boycott. And the workers were powerful enough at that period, and in the midst of a mass movement like a strike, that they could defy him and carry on the strike without his support. Well, after the strike victory, the people who were elected to these paid rep positions had been the leaders of the strike who had defied Caesar during the strike. That was the beginning of the problem. And there was a whole different attitude towards what was the most powerful farm worker weapon. Caesar continued to believe that it was a boycott. The workers continued to believe that it was a strike. There was a disagreement over whether there should be a continued organizing. The UFW, even though it was highly successful, still only had a third of the vegetable industry organized. Caesar didn't want to expand it. He wanted to consolidate. He felt that there was a problem of control. And the workers felt that they needed to expand it. There was a big difference over that. There was a whole different outlook in politics. They didn't hate the fields. That was where they considered themselves craftsmen. They were proud of being farm workers. And they were doing very well in life. Yeah, largely because of the success of the UFW. And they to have that success, they needed cooperation with the UFW staff, they needed the cooperation of all these unions and the liberals and all that. They needed that. But it wasn't like they were these poor, suffering farm workers. They weren't like that at all. That was a huge clash on difference over the very meaning of the fields. And it was like two separate worlds that came into collision. Chavez and the staff won that fight, and in the process of winning that fight, they trampled the very best of the rank and file, and they destroyed a union.
Frank Bardakey is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Trampling Out the Vintage. I'm Sasha Lilly, and the program is Against the Grain. We are running out of time, so unfortunately we're compressing a lot of history into a short amount of time, but that differing vision about the workers as empowered collective actors or victims who have been set upon by these larger forces really played out in the 1980s as the UFW took on a somewhat different form, although you argue in the book that it wasn't a break from the past, that those elements were contained within the union, within the dynamics, but the union became transformed to more of a worker advocacy organization. It tried to appeal to people who might be concerned about the poor plight of these people and not a rank-and-file-driven, militant organization. Mm-hmm. So what was the fate of the union in terms of how many workers it ended up retaining within this union and its power with the growers through that time?
There's this Victoria strike in 1979 that I just described. By the mid-1980s, the union is basically finished. There was there's about 5,000 union members right now who have contracts that that are not really any better than the actual wages and conditions of anybody else in the fields. So in the fields, the union was pretty much defeated in the 1980s. I'll talk about that in a second, how the dynamics there. And what the union remains as kind of a farm worker advocacy group and a bit of a family business. But it's essentially a farm worker advocacy group, which in and of itself, there's nothing wrong with farm worker advocacy. But it's not a living, strong, vital union force in the fields anymore. What happened was that after, right on the tail of this internecine fight between the leaders of the rank and file in the vegetable industry and the union staff, Duke Majum was elected governor.
Republican governor of California.
Yeah, Republican governor of California, and he had run on an anti UFW platform, and there was a grower offensive, a counter-offensive. Growers had all kinds of ways. You know, one of the stories is it's a mistake to focus too much on the internal history of the UFW and forget how powerful California agriculture is. And so California agriculture bid its time, and then when Duke Majum came in, and they knew about this internal fight, they knew what had happened. And they got out of the union in various ways. Lots of times they just changed the name of the company, and there was no succession clause in the contracts, and they had a new company, and they just got out of the union that way. That happened lots of times. And the UFW was in no position to fight back. They were simply in no position to fight back because the leadership on the ground had been politically emasculated. And the attempts to renew the boycott, it's the 80s, it's not the 60s, and was basically impossible. So the UFW kind of limped along until it found its way, and its way was to become this kind of advocacy group and immigrant advocacy group.
So why would you say that the official story of why the UFW, the United Farm Workers, went into decline was because of this grower offensive that you describe, which was, of course, real, that, as you say, there was a Republican governor that kind of changed the terrain for the United Farm Workers. Their political allies weren't as strong. That altered the picture as well. And then at the same time, in Mexico, in 1984, there was the peso crisis, and you had a lot of new immigrants coming. That's sort of the official explanation for the UFW's decline. Why do you not buy that as the explanation for the United Farm Workers' demise, or at least enough of an explanation for it?
Well, I mean, it's part of the explanation. It's absolutely part of the explanation. they floated the peso, and as people in Mexico say, it floated like a rock. And in 1982, and there was this whole wave of new immigrants. And another part of this story that I haven't talked about at all today was that the UFW, from you can sort of guess from what I was saying, in much of its life was anti-immigrant. It sort of protected domestic, protected the sort of domestic legal worker against illegal immigration, what they considered illegal immigration. That's a complicated story. We could talk another hour about that story. But in the face of that, and in the grower, what I call the grower flexibility, it would have been difficult for the UFW to hold on. But they didn't even have a chance because they had internally self-destructed. And if the unity between the staff and that farm worker leadership and those crews had continued, if somehow Chavez had been able to incorporate gladly farm worker power into the actual structural organization of the UFW, I think they would have had a fighting chance.
And it's interesting, too, because at the time this is all happening, there was a restructuring of the way that agriculture was organized.
Absolutely.
But it wasn't that it became obsolete or mechanized, you know, or any of those things where people stopped eating vegetables. Just the opposite. Yep. There was this great expansion, yep, which in theory could have been an aid to, you know, militant, yeah, battles.
You know, that's really important. It's important to people to understand it's not like the decline of the unions in the industrial sector, in industrial America, because the vegetable industry, the fruit and vegetable industry where the UFW was based, is tremendously expanding in this period. It's not going anywhere. It didn't go offshore. It can't go offshore as far. Well, it can to a certain extent, but it wasn't going offshore. It was just constantly expanding. So the UFW was defeated in a period where the industry is on the rise. But, you know, you can sort of read my book for the details, but basically what happened was the UFW had contracts with a series of grower shippers, large grower shippers. And what the industry did was just the grower shippers went out of business and they turned the business over to a whole different set of people and basically passed union work to non-union companies. At the same time that was happening, because there was such a great expansion in vegetable consumption and more exotic vegetables that people didn't eat before, the very large retail stores, the supermarkets, didn't want to deal with so many grower shippers. So the grower shippers were phased out, and they deal with now shipper retailers, people like Fresh Pick, and you've heard the names of Antel Demerara, all those various, the six or seven major producers. So those two things happened at the same time and reinforced each other.
Trampling out the vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers, sure to be a classic. Frank Bardicky, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you very much, Sasha. Thanks for having me.
And Frank Bardicky is the author also of Good Liberals and Great Blue Herons and translator of Shadows of Tender Fury, the letters and communiques of Subcomandante Marcos and the Zapatista Army of National Liberation. He is a teacher in Watsonville, California, and was a farm worker in the Salinas Valley for six seasons. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.